Welcome back to another episode of All Else Equal, a podcast connecting student inquiry with faculty expertise. Today's question comes from a current student in my Principles of Micro course, Audra Pesco.
Hey Jason and Florence, this is Audra Pesco. I've got a question that's kind of about education, nonprofits, and impact. Lots of high school students form their own organizations or nonprofits to deliver some sort of service to individuals in need. Some of these are beneficial, but others merely serve as credentials to get a student into a top university. To what extent would it be better to steer these ambitious students towards more established nonprofits rather than creating their own pop-up organization? Thanks.
This is a great question. So we talk a lot about signaling in economics, especially when it comes to labor markets.
So Kirk Doran has been an awesome addition to the finance faculty this year, and I know his research ideas straddle a few different concepts surrounding labor, innovation, and education. Kirk is the Henkels Family Collegiate Chair, and he is an associate professor of economics here at Notre Dame. Let's call up Kirk. Hey, Kirk. Thank you so much for joining us today and chatting with Force and I.
My pleasure. It's awesome to be here with you guys.
So I really like Audra's question because it brings up at least two things that economists care a lot about. How should we think about education and how can we encourage innovation? And before we get into the weeds, let me just ask you, Kirk, how many nonprofits are your, is it six at the time of this recording, maybe seven, children going to start before college?
I don't know, but I hope they help me with the nonprofit I'm actually starting right now, which I want to take the opportunity to advertise.
This is our first plug.
Thomas More Academy of South Bend, and we are going to be opening up a classical school. It's going to train kids in classical pedagogy, teach kids how to fish rather than give them fish. And that's super important because we're all about giving people fish. I love fish just as much as the next man. But how much better it is to actually be taught how to fish. So that's what we're going to do in that school.
So what grades is this going to be for? And like, can you just give us a little bit more of the details? I'm just interested. I love how much like you're just like this guy that's like constantly thinking about
your wife's
going to
be teaching the school. She didn't tell you this first. Your wife's going to be teaching. You're also going to be teaching, but you're teaching. She'll get paid. The people get paid according to their productivity here first. So she'll get paid. it's going to be elementary grades next year, but the number of grades will depend on in part on demand. But we've got a great supply of teachers we're already talking to, and I'm super excited about it.
That's great. So, I mean, we'll put a link in a description in our podcast description.
Yeah, we'll keep plugging it.
Yeah, I think it's really cool, and that ties very, very well into what we're kind of talking about today, right?
Yeah.
So teaching people to fish. You know, so if we're thinking about kind of the right way to position students to be successful and have fulfilling lives, you know, maybe that's like different than like kind of like what is going to look best on your resume for getting into college. Like how should students think about balancing that like right now? Right now is, you know, this is a podcast geared towards Notre Dame undergrads, towards, you know, going on the job market, or is like, you know, as high school students, like how do we encourage people to do that?
I think it's a great question. So, I mean, one thing that Notre Dame aspires to is training the next generation of people in leadership positions around the country and increasingly around the world. And these are people who are going to be starting organizations later. They're going to be growing organizations later. They're going to be in management positions in those organizations, not just companies, for-profit companies, but also nonprofit organizations, et cetera, in their communities. And we need that. We need those people. They've got to go to school somewhere. Many of them aspire to go to a school at Notre Dame, and Notre Dame aspires to teach them. So I think it actually kind of makes sense if you're interested in becoming a Notre Dame student or a student at a similar university to actually demonstrate that you're trying to learn by doing how to start things and how to lead things. It's often interpreted as resume padding, but a lot of things that can be good can also be bad depending on your intentions and what you're communicating. So a person could resume pad and start organizations they don't care about. But what I would recommend is not doing that. But yeah, try to have some leadership roles and some founding roles and things you do care about. Now, the student asked a really interesting question, which is, well, if you care about providing these services, why not just join an organization that already provides those services? And then you're just a bright worker for that organization. Wouldn't you provide better services? My answer is you absolutely would provide better services. And you would get zero skills in learning how to start something. So later in life, when you're expected to start things in your communities and build things and head up things, You wouldn't have had any experience with that. So that's why I think we can't look at our years of formative education as 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, just in terms of what's my best ability to provide services or do tasks today. Rather, we should be thinking about the classic way economists frame the education decision. Can I invest in something in a costly way today? Costly, not just in terms of intrinsic costs, but implicit costs, like the opportunity cost of my time. I could be working for an organization that already exists, right? A big opportunity cost. Can I invest those big opportunity costs today as a young person so that I can learn how to do awesome things? One of those being founding nonprofits and getting things going in your community later on in life when I'm done getting my education. So that's how I'd frame it. I totally agree people should avoid resume padding, but I also think people should dive into non-resume padding style investments and learning how to lead things and to grow things.
If we're just thinking about like a kind of strict labor market returns to higher education, like how should we think about the role of a university like Notre Dame in shaping those labor market outcomes?
Well, yeah. So if you don't mind my jumping the gun, I guess this connects to issues of signaling and human capital formation. So there are kind of credentialing effects that happen when people get a credential. Sometimes they call them sheepskin effects because degrees used to be on sheepskin.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Yes. The last sheepskin degree I've seen was my mother's degree from Johns Hopkins. She's a PhD from Johns Hopkins. I won't tell you how long ago because I love my mother. And I want her to keep loving me. But yes, sometime in the past, they used to slaughter a sheep of the field and use its skin to actually print these degrees. Anyway,
the student so these doesn't sheep, have to do this, right?
The students have to do it themselves. We
the lamb afterwards. That's your final exam, your final exam.
Lamb chops. It was so good. It was actually Shaun the Sheep. I'm sorry. That's why there's no more Shaun the Sheep shows.
We'll include a trigger warning before the
exactly. episode. Trigger warning.
Yeah.
Trigger warning. Okay. I actually love Shaun the Sheep. He's delicious. But the upshot is that these sheepskin or credentialing effects, they show up, and we know that there are some effects of that nature. But the theory we have to explain those is that it's a signaling theory. The idea is that it may actually be less costly in some sense for somebody to get more education if their raw ability is higher. And if their raw ability is higher, they can get that 100 in math easier than somebody whose raw ability is lower. So then under certain circumstances, you can have an equilibrium where people who have high ability will tend to get education and people who have low ability will tend not to get education, as much education. And under those circumstances, you can end up having firms rationally decide to pay more to higher educated people merely because it's a signal of higher ability.
I mean, but there's no human capital formation at all in that.
Right.
In that story. That's a theory
there. And we have some evidence that's consistent with that theory. And I think there is some signaling that goes on. But I guess what I would emphasize is that theory isn't super consonant with a lot of the empirical evidence we have about the effects of, for instance, massive school building campaigns in Indonesia or massive cohort-based changes in people's education requirements in places like the United Kingdom. When you look at settings like that, an entire cohort, for very publicly available reasons, for publicly known reasons, has significantly more education than another otherwise similar cohort of people. And the first cohort with the significantly higher education for publicly known reasons ends up getting significantly higher wages than the other cohort. It's hard to square that with an idea of signaling because it's well known why the first cohort has more education than the second cohort. So the relative education between the cohorts in average years is known to be determined by these law changes. So if you have wages changing as a result, what would they be signaling in terms of ability? So I think that signaling's got to explain part of it, but for reasons like I just described, I don't think signaling explains all of it.
So what is it doing? Economists will kind of measure these things as saying, look, this cohort that got higher levels of education ended up making higher returns in labor markets. And what is it? Are they like people just like able to make widgets faster if they take calculus?
Yeah, so I mean, it's doing a lot of things. One thing that I find that people learn at Notre Dame is once they get to college, they learn how to ask the next question that determines whether they really understand the topic or not. Whereas in high school, they had mostly heretofore learned how to memorize things really, really fast and regurgitate them quickly. So at every stage in the process, they're learning some things. That isn't to demean high school, but at every stage in the process, they're learning some things that could be relevant in a more general sense. Let's just unpack that idea of learning how to ask the next question. Almost any job that has any non-rote component whatsoever, you're going to have to figure out what it is you don't know about what it is you need to do. And the faster and better you can figure out what you don't know about what it is you need to do, and the more confident you are that this is the area that I don't know, and this is what I need to do to eliminate my ignorance, the more productive you're going to be, and the better you'll be for your employer. That's training that requires being exposed to the requirement to learn chains of logic and to learn concepts that are new. Across a wide spectrum of areas, mathematical areas, scientific areas, linguistic areas, et cetera. So a liberal arts style education with core requirements like we have at Notre Dame, coupled with pretty rigorous majors, should even in the College of Arts and Letters, be training people to be, I would say, considerably more productive in their future careers.
Was going to shift gears to taking a jab at Mendoza,
Anytime you want, Forrest. Let's hear it.
and promoting the idea of studying everything and doing anything, but we shouldn't go down that digression.
Well, we could just talk about how Mendoza is amazing because the typical undergraduate there, I think the year after graduation, makes something like $57,400 first year after Mendoza, which is really, really similar to the $58,400 that they make from an econ degree in the College of Arts and Letters. So I'm impressed by that, what you're able to
You
do.
are officially my favorite guest on the podcast.
So, thinking ahead a little bit in terms of this idea of human capital formation and signaling, if let's imagine a world where everyone then goes to college, they create these logic chains, they all have the same signal. How do we then start determining kind of what is the next signal?
Right. I mean, that's one of the reasons your question could be refigured as one of the reasons why I don't think signaling is the primary thing at work. I think the primary thing at work is that they're actually getting better at thinking and therefore more productive. So I'm a proponent of the human capital theory so let me explain that fully because I explained the signaling one fairly deeply and I want to make sure I explain the human capital one. To make it clear, I actually do think we're better at doing things after 4 years of college than we were before. And not just because we're 4 years older, but because our brain has been stretched in very well-defined and consistent ways by 4 years of thinking clearly. And that makes people better at a whole host of different jobs. That's the theory that I think has the most support.
So you've done a lot of work thinking about the economics of innovation. Could you tell us about like some of the work that you've done and then maybe tie this back to this, you know, this idea of the role of education in either signaling or in, you know, more maybe more importantly in human capital formation?
Sure. So I've done some work on the intersection between innovation economics and labor economics. So let me explain innovation economics for a little bit here. One of the core insights in innovation economics is this point that Nobel laureate Paul Romer made, which is that if we want to understand how economies grow, economies have to grow from something that has the following feature. If I use it and Jason uses it and Forrest uses it all at the same time, there's not any less of it than if only one of us was using it. Now, there's only one thing in the world that really has that feature intrinsically and completely, and that's knowledge. If I use the Pythagorean theorem and Jason uses the Pythagorean theorem and Forrest uses the Pythagorean theorem all at once, there's still just as much Pythagorean theorem as there used to be. What that means is if we double all the inputs to production in society, all the factories, all the people, and all the knowledge, then everyone will have just as many factories as they had before, and the factories will have just as many people as they had before, but all of us will have twice as much knowledge as we had before. And that means all of us will be able to produce more per person than we used to. So that is the increasing returns to scale. We double all the inputs, we more than double the outputs. And that increasing returns to scale is the foundation of per capita economic growth, which is why we're able to have this conversation today instead of working in the fields But the upshot of it is that that creates a whole bunch of weird situations in these knowledge markets, because if knowledge, the thing that we care about the most, is non-rival, meaning we can all use it at the same time without there being less of it, that means it's not a private good. And if it's not a private good, then all of the stuff from the first 80% of every principles of microclass no longer applies. Instead, it's the stuff that I just taught my class last week about non-private goods. And that stuff's weird. Free markets don't do a great job of allocating non-private goods, and there's a bunch of well-known ways in which they can go awry. So that opens up their areas for people like me. I'm an empirical researcher. I specialize in labor markets. So I think about the ways labor markets may intersect with those market imperfections. One area where that can happen is that, you know, you've got these really smart people and they're just full of ideas, and everybody who gets to interact with them also becomes full of ideas, but not everybody can interact with them. What does it mean when those people move around the world? What does it mean when they move from firm to firm or from city to city? And what does it mean for everybody else in the locations that they were in or the locations they entered? It gets more abstract than that. What does it mean for everybody in the location in the space of ideas that they used to be populating with their wisdom? And now they've moved to a different location in the space of ideas. They used to be working on algebraic geometry, and now they're a physicist. Well, you know, they used to be studying chemistry. Now they're making inventions in biochemistry. When they change the topics they work on, in other words, they move in the space of ideas, what happens to the people who were in the old locations, who just lost an amazing colleague who used to fertilize their field with a lot of insights? And what happens to the people in the new locations that just gained a brilliant person who might fertilize their field with brilliant insights? And then what does all that mean for what our laws should be, our regulations should be, and, you know, what funding mechanisms we should have for science? So that's what I work on.
So in this time of kind of COVID here, where I don't know, do you think it makes it easier for people to kind of cross-pollinate in different idea cohorts?
Interesting point, Jason. I think it can. I mean, the big limiting factor for this cross-pollination, which is so important because it's really recombinant knowledge that's the source of the best knowledge we have for growth. You know, that cross-pollination, it requires people to know that someone they might want to talk to exists. And so on the one hand, during the COVID era, we've all gotten used to communicating via Zoom. So people you already know exist and who already know you exist, it's much easier for us to arrange a seminar, if you will, with them. But the problem is chance meetings are a lot harder in the COVID era. Mm-hmm. And those chance meetings can have the really most exciting combinations, because this person's in your department. You didn't even know they existed. They just got hired last year while you were on sabbatical. You come back, there's this brilliant person, and she's got great insights in an area you never would have looked at if you hadn't happened to have lunch with her. So that's a lot harder in the COVID era. And I fear that we're going to be missing out on those things until we start meeting randomly again.
That's interesting, right? So even though we're not meeting at the water cooler, and we have the opportunity to reduce frictions to actually meet, we actually still need to meet at the water cooler.
Yes.
In order to actually, you know, have kind of new ideas form. I think that's really interesting.
Well, let me get you to play policy guru for a second. From Notre Dame's perspective, like, what does Notre Dame do well that encourages this type of, collaboration or chance meetings? And like, what could they do better if you could kind of wave a magic wand and think about either during COVID times or during normal times, kind of when we go back to normal, you know, what are ways that this university could improve?
Well, the one thing they've done really, really well is that they had the combination of courage and carefulness that allowed us to open in person again. That was super important, and it has resulted in some good conversations, research conversations that I've had here, as well as I believe better teaching on my end. And so, you know, I've had those research contacts with students and with fellow faculty because of that. So that's super, super important. And it's been more productive than it was last spring when we were locked down.
Yeah, I think Jason and I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
And so that was super. And it took both carefulness. Some schools were courageous and some schools were careful. We were both. And, you know, I'm on the Summit Princeton alum, and President Eisengruber of Princeton recently said, some schools have actually opened up and they've been able to contain all of their case explosions quickly. And so this means maybe we should open up too. It just feels awesome to have Notre Dame leading the Ivies that way. So congratulations to Princeton for thinking about following us. Big congratulations to Notre Dame for setting the example there. So what could we do better? I mean, I think what we could do better is we could find ways to make use of COVID testing to actually bring people here. So it would be really nice to be able to have research trips here and research trips abroad. And I think with the benefit of saliva testing and a little bit of work perhaps at the airport or perhaps elsewhere, we could invest the resources to actually have research collaborations in person here, some conferences, and allow us to go to some conferences too at places that are courageous enough to open them. So the key to that testing is the fact that you have to balance off the possibilities of false positives and false negatives. But we have a really great system for that because we have multiple levels of testing here. So I would encourage the university, knowing that it may take years for the virus to work its way through the population, and knowing that we want to have and we need to have the ability to interact, not randomly, but in a way that's unplanned. These unplanned interactions require a fair amount of physical presence. So I would encourage them to be creative about testing in isolation in regards to research trips as they have been in regards to the university as a whole.
So we're running low on time, but I wanted to ask you from a Notre Dame student's perspective, you know, what should they do to, if they're thinking about kind of maximizing their time here with regards to kind of positioning themselves to have, you know, a big impact after graduation, kind of what does your research say that like they should be, maybe that they're underweighting?
Right. What they're underweighting is like direct interaction with, collaboration with really, really brilliant people. So they need early on to start getting the skills necessary so that they can not just receive a course from, but collaborate in the creation of something with and in the production of something with some of the really brilliant people that are here. And if they can do that, that's going to have big, big spillovers that are lasting on what they can do later in life. So they should take advantage of it while they're here.
That's perfect. Thanks for adding to our human capital. Yeah. Kirk, we really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kirk.
Guys. It's a pleasure talking to you guys.
I just love talking to Kirk. He's like freaking brilliant. Every time we're talking, I'm kind of hoping secretly that some sort of this osmosis he's talking about is happening. Like he's just sharing his human capital with me.
That's right. I feel exactly the same way. This podcast has kind of been like our water cooler, right? So to speak. I feel like we've been able to help everyone gain some human capital. Well, that's it for another episode of All Else Equal. Remember, submit your questions to allelseequalpodcast@gmail.com.
We'll put up a link to Q's in the description box of this episode. Also, stay tuned for a special All Else Equal opportunity over winter break. Here's a hint. It's a book club. Jason wants us to do a book club. And so we're going to do a book club over winter break.